You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find these episodes encouraging.
Theme this evening is money, 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 money in the wisdom literature. Wisdom literature being the books of Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes, and a little bit of Psalms. Sometimes that's included in there. I grew up in a family that wasn't terrible at talking about money, but I recognize that it's a bit of a family of origin thing. Does anyone here feel like they grew up with parents who spoke well about money in their household? Okay, I'm getting some definite shaking of the head. Was there anyone who thinks that their parents spoke well about money? Nope. Okay. Our bar is low. Let's turn to the Bible. I would love to be here today and by the end of it, we come up with a biblical concept of money. That would be really nice. We're not going to, because I don't think there is one. I think there are biblical concepts of money. There's different ways that the Bible speaks about it in different times. And one of the things that we saw last week was Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. They deal with every issue in really different ways. Hence, we're doing them all together. One of the things that we'll find is that if somebody has had a pretty good life, they're fairly well off, things are going nicely for them, and they've never really faced too much trouble, the trend is they really like the book of Proverbs. They love Proverbs because Proverbs says things like, those who are wise prosper. Ergo, if you're prospering, backwards map that, you're wise. It's a wonderful feeling, isn't it? So if things are going well for you in life, you're going to love the book of Proverbs. I'm going to hazard a guess, though, that for most of our community, we're going to look at Proverbs and most of the time it's a bit cringy. I know I found that last week as I was speaking. I read some of them out and you're like, ew. But then we get to Job and Ecclesiastes and we all sort of breathe this sigh of like, ah, my people. We feel it, hey, like we get it. It's like, this is the nitty gritty. So I'm going to draw three threads together from these three different books. And for me, as I've been reflecting on this week, it's not so much rules, regulations, things we have to do so much for me as postures that I want to bring when it comes to thinking about money. So my first posture that I want to think about is I want a holistic view of wealth according to these three different books. Holistic view. Second posture, throughout the Bible, we do get a common theme of generosity and stewardship. They're two key ideas that come up. And the third idea that keeps coming up is contentment and trust in God when it comes to wealth. So they're the three postures that we're going to see, but we're not going to get there just yet. I'm a researcher in my other job that I do. And so I thought, hey, let's look at what the research says about money. Let's see what behavioral scientists have to say about wealth. I've got a few slides for us. Bryony, can we go to the first slide? Okay, this one. High income improves evaluation of life, but not emotional well-being. You've probably heard the saying, money can't buy happiness. Now, that was largely an idea that's been debunked because indeed money really can buy happiness. Those of us who aren't super wealthy, we like to think that the super rich are miserable, don't we? Like, you know, they can't be happy. That all they've got is money. No, actually, money buys a huge amount of happiness. Like we're talking heaps of happiness. If you're wealthy, you're much more likely to be happy. Now, these guys, Kahneman and Deaton, they won a Nobel Peace Prize, or a Nobel Prize in Economics for their thinking around money and wealth. And what they found, this was back in 2010, they found there was a plateau of happiness. So you would earn, and they would correlate up until you got to about $78,000. So like thinking today, maybe $108,000. So, you know, that's per year, a couple of hundred thousand income. That's a tidy income. And at that point, it will kind of plateau and it would stop being quite such an extreme, like, you know, money equals happiness situation. Now, other studies have since debunked that, so they can give back their Nobel Prize. But one of the things that they also found was if you stopped looking at happiness and just looked at life satisfaction, then that didn't stop. That just kept going up and up and up and up. So the more money that people got, the more satisfied they felt about life. You can do with that information what you will. Just keep striving for more money is my advice, because it makes you content. But the question is, do we just want happiness in life? I guess that we have to then ask that question. So let's move to the next study. Having less, giving more, the influence of social class on pro-social behavior. Now, these studies were particularly interesting. They took wealthy, high-income people and compared them to low-income people, and they got them to do a series of tasks. And one of the things that they found over and over again was that the lower-income individuals were more generous, they were more charitable, they were more trusting, and they were more helpful compared to their upper-class companions. What is it about wealth that, I want to use the word, corrupts the personality? There is something about it that starts undoing the pro-social instincts that we have. These researchers, they were able to work with a few variables, and they found that it was a desire to care for people in the same rung as you. And that was what enabled the pro-social behavior. So if you're rich, you're just a bit of a jerk. Next slide. Is more always, aren't these fascinating? I loved this, I had such fun. I should have preferred the Bible, but no, this is good fun. Is more always better? A survey on positional concerns. This one found, If people were given the opportunity to either lose half their wealth or be more wealthy than the people around them, they chose the latter. So the logic goes, when it comes to life satisfaction and happiness, presumably, they're not quite sure yet, I will be more happy if I am surrounded by people who are poorer than me. Yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Because we live in constant comparison. And this study just proved that is part of the human psyche that just seems really hard to buck. Now, it also was true of attractiveness. I thought that was interesting. If you compare yourself to everyone around you, then you're going to feel better. But it wasn't true of number of days you get on vacation each year. So that was less of a variable. That wasn't quite the power play that people thought that it was. Okay, here's another one. This is the last one for this section. High social class predicts increased unethical behavior, similar to what we saw earlier, but here's the negatives of it. So that in the previous one, we saw that lower socioeconomic, they were more likely to do pro-social behavior. Here, high class was more likely to have exhibit unethical decision-making tendencies, take valued goods from others, lie in a negotiation, cheat to increase chances of winning a prize, and endorse unethical behavior at work. The rich are just not cool, hey. They're just a piece of work. I mean, in every way, on a global scale, I know Thomas and I would be considered wealthy. Most of the people in this room, we would be considered really, really wealthy. And we don't like to think that we're dicks, do we? I hope not. I don't. Like, I don't like to think that about myself. But there was a stunning silence in the room just there, like, Joel, watch out. I'm really conscious that as a church, as we look at this idea of money, there are all these elements of human psychology, behavioral psychology, there are all these elements of, I don't know, reality that sometimes can collide with how we want to show up. And so I could be here and be like, you fools, don't be foolish, be nice, be generous, and lay out the rules, but I don't think that's going to work. I think we need something far more foundational. I think we need something transformative if we're going to rise above these stats. So I was thinking this week about how money has been handled in church and society. I was thinking a lot about it. So here's a couple of screenshots that I grabbed as I was just pondering it through the week. Next slide. Let's start with the right. The Pope has done a visit to Southeast Asia. Don't know if you saw this in the news. Indonesia, Timor Leste, a number of countries in the region, which is quite strange because they're really minority Catholic or Catholic countries there. But one of the things that has stood out in Indonesia is he has gained heaps of praise in this Muslim majority nation because locally there's been lots of scandals around inappropriate flexing of wealth. The Pope has rocked up and he's driven a Fiat and had the window down and just been really normal and down to earth. Now, I look at that and I think you cannot call the Pope poor. That is not a conclusion that you can make. But here, he has pretended to be poor and it's gone really well with the locals. I don't know what to make of that. I don't know, like pretend to be poor and people will like you. There's something about the church in general, not just the Catholic Church, as though the Catholic Church is easy to beat up on. All churches these days are easy to beat up on. There is something about wealth that has been hoarded by religious institutions that is, I think, anti-Christ. I don't think that you can conclude it any other way. I will happily get out my politics here and say I'm not comfortable with neoliberal capitalism. Like, I just think there's a way of handling money and the church has bought into it such that the church has married money and power and it's corrupted on so many different fronts. And maybe we see a portion of this here. And when we read, oh, the Pope's getting good press for looking like he's poor, I don't buy it. I just can't by that. So that's one dynamic that I saw this week. On the left here, oh, there's a sign. Please do not feed the birds. Feeding creates a dependent population that is a potential health hazard and makes a costly mess. Now, Megan Basham is a right-wing commentator in the States. She's written a book called, I can't remember, and I didn't read it, so I can't actually comment on it at all. But it got lots of headlines about a month ago, something about buying shepherds from the left. But she's really angry that the evangelical church has rich people in it, which is an interesting concept because she said here, happens with humans too. That's why 2 Thessalonians 3:10 tells us, if anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. In other words, we should not be redistributing wealth among society. That's what she would very much stand for. Each person should work hard and then they should earn money. In Australia, we've had a long discussion around dole bludges. That was a term that was really potent. It's that mindset. We can't redistribute wealth to the poor because then they'll just be lazy. We can't give it to refugees because then they won't stand on their own two feet. That we can't give it to those who are struggling because then, you know, we'll just endlessly give money. Now, I'm a social worker. I butt against that. I read that and I was like, oh, but yeah, the 2 Thessalonians, it does actually say that. So how am I to make sense of this? Until I managed to put it in context, we love context. Context is just a nice thing. You can explain many things away with context. It's dangerous. But putting this in context, most scholars agree that Paul is writing to the wealthy in Thessalonica here. And in Thessalonica, we know that there was a wealthy upper class. And what did they do with their time? They didn't work. They got the slaves to work on their behalf. And so they did nothing. And they would rock up to events, eat all the food, and leave the poor with nothing. And so that was the context that would be happening here. And Paul is saying, actually, no, like to you wealthy folk, get a job. Do some work, and then you can eat at the feast of the church. She's saying, yeah, no, don't give the money to the poor. It's the exact opposite. See where that's heading? Ah, oh, gosh. The messages get corrupted. I am so for redistribution of wealth. I just think there are no-brainers there, and I'm happy to talk all day about that. Next slide. This is Peter Hayward, a great artist. He's written in a Google Translate, picking up Christianese. You need to be in church for community. So often pastors say that. Who's ever heard anyone say that? Who said that from the front? You need to be in church for community. So often, and I know this because I've been a pastor in a number of churches, what actually is being said there is, we're trying to run a business here, folks. We need you to come along on a Sunday and give money if we're going to keep this thing going, if we're going to keep me employed. It grates so much. That's just a reality of church life in modern day world. So I'll leave that there as a message that has been around. And then finally here, I love a graph that's dropping a hint. On the top, we see wealth distribution in France, 1760 to 1790. And then the bottom, wealth distribution in the US, 2016. And we see that in both. The top 10% of the population earned the top 20% earned so much wealth. And the top 10% earned a huge slab of the wealth. And then the rest of it was allowed to exist amongst everyone else. Such that, I didn't actually fact check this, but it's a great graph to go off. There is increasing wealth disparity across the West. The wealth disparity in the US is obscene. The wealth disparity in Australia is not far behind it. So we just got to sit with that reality. And as a church, recognize that we are political. The gospel is political. Bible is political. Any questions or thoughts about all those pictures that were up there before we dive into some wisdom literature? There's some interesting thoughts there, aren't there? It was helpful for me this week thinking, oh, I've got to talk about money on Sunday. And all of a sudden, I saw it everywhere. All of a sudden, I saw on my Facebook feed money being spoken about. Next slide, Bryony will jump into this one. This is our last study, because I actually think a lot of the studies prop up what we're going to see in the wisdom literature. And there's this beautiful synergy that happens when ancient wisdom is discovered by modern researchers. There's some irony there. Does spending money on others promote happiness? The answer is yes, entirely. They got people to give money or to keep the money, and those who gave the money reported far higher happiness levels than those who kept the money. In another study, they got people to just remember a time when they gave money to somebody else, and they reported far higher levels of satisfaction with their behavior, which was in line with their values, which propped up happiness. So, again, we could sit here and be like, you need to be generous because the Bible says it. Or we could sit here and say, hey, here's an invitation for you to be flourishing in life. What does it mean to give and find happiness in generosity? Any questions about these ones or this one? It's interesting. Hey, let's jump into the wisdom literature. Shall we do it? Let's go Proverbs first. Next slide, Bryony, just so that we don't have those up there distracting. Proverbs. Proverbs is full of pithy sayings. It's full of wise advice. And it advocates as a whole for honesty, for diligence, generosity. As I said earlier, the book of Proverbs will make you feel really good if things are going well for your life. So, for example, Proverbs 10, verse 4, lazy hands make for poverty, but diligent hands bring wealth. Lazy hands, that's Proverbs 10, 4, lazy hands make for poverty, but diligent hands bring wealth. Now, we can all sit here and think, yeah, I know someone who's really lazy, and yeah, they don't have super amounts of wealth. That makes sense. Act in A manner, B flows on from it. But on the flip side, we can probably sit here and think, I know plenty of really wealthy people, or I know of plenty of really wealthy people who we wouldn't say are diligent. Maybe they married into money. Maybe they were beneficiaries of generational money, who did absolutely jack all for it, and yet they have large amounts of wealth. So I don't know if I trust Proverbs 10:4 as a rule, but it's there as some nice advice. Proverbs 13:11, dishonest money dwindles away, but whoever gathers money little by little makes it grow. Dishonest money dwindles away, but whoever gathers money little by little makes it grow. Be careful with your pennies and the pounds will take care of himself, my mum used to say. I quite like that. Just stashing up slowly, slowly, working hard. Again, I'm sure we can all think of people who have been dishonest in their handling of money, and their money has seemed to just grow and grow and grow. And it feels unfair, doesn't it? But Proverbs certainly says that one of the things we should be aiming for in our posture, remember we're thinking about postures, is diligence and righteousness. It also thinks about generosity and compassion. Proverbs 11, 24 to 25. One person gives freely, yet gains even more. Another person withholds unduly, but comes to poverty. A generous person will prosper. Whoever refreshes others will be refreshed. For those who are giving out generously, they're going to be refreshed in themselves. Proverbs seems to suggest that people who are generous are going to prosper. Proverbs 11:28. Those who trust in their riches will fall, but the righteous will thrive like a green leaf. And Proverbs 23:4-5. Do not wear yourself out to get rich. Don't trust your own cleverness. Cast but a glance at riches and they're gone. For they will shortly sprout wings and fly off to the sky like an eagle, says Proverbs. So there's some good wisdom to hold on to. As always, the book of Proverbs is not set out like a manual for holding wealth. It's not a guidebook that says, if you do X, then everything is going to go perfect. We like to treat it like that sometimes, but it just doesn't function that way. Instead, here are some good principles that can help guide our decision-making. Enough on Proverbs for now. Let's get to some nitty-gritty, because Job is going to have the exact opposite experience. The book of Job presents this meditation on the role of wealth in the context of suffering. Job is a wealthy man. He's described as righteous, so much so that it almost seems as though he's sinless in the way that Job 1 and 2 is written. He worships God, Yahweh, holy. He has no blemish. He's this, like, just a good, good guy. And yet, because of a deal made in heaven, all of his wealth is stripped away from him. And so over a period of days, weeks, and months, he loses his money, he loses his house, he loses his children, he loses his property. Everything just disappears from underneath him. And no one can say that Job wasn't a hard worker. He was. No one can say that Job wasn't a righteous man. He most certainly was. But here's Job's reflection in Job 1:21. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of Yahweh be praised. In Job, there is a theme of God's sovereignty over wealth. God can give and God can take away. And God is truly present in both the giving, and God is truly present in the taking away. God is there. And I don't like this picture of God. It grates with me. But there's something liberating about it. There's something comforting about it, to know that even when it feels like the rug has been pulled out from underneath me, maybe there's something bigger. Maybe there is a better God. Here's one conclusion that I can't draw from the book of Job that I know lots of people have in the past. And maybe you sit with this fine. And you know that if that's the case, that's all power to you. One of the things that has come up in teaching that I've heard is Job remained faithful, and therefore God restored all of Job's wealth to him. So therefore, if we remain faithful, our wealth will be restored to us. I think there is an element of truth in that. But for me, the thing I want to question is, and what about maybe Job's son, for example, who also remained faithful, but was never restored to wealth, was never, in fact, died. We like to think of ourselves as Job in this story, but maybe we're not Job in the story. Maybe we're another character. And so I want to complicate that narrative to say, oh, if you remain faithful, then your wealth will come to you. It may well be the case, but it's certainly not a theological promise that we can stand on. Does that make sense? I think we just got to be really careful with that. And so Job emphasizes that wealth is temporary, that wealth comes and goes, but it certainly cannot be the foundation of your identity or security. In Job 31, verses 24 to 28, if I have put my trust in gold or said to pure gold, you are my security, then these also would be sins to be judged, for I would have been unfaithful to God on high. Job seems to be saying, for me, as I pursue God, what I can't do is say, money, you're everything I have. That would be a step in the wrong direction, out of step with the Creator. Are we comfortable with what we've covered in Job? Yep. It gets a bit heavy. It's about to get one step heavier. Ecclesiastes, the saying that we came to multiple times last week, was eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Woohoo! Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, says the author of Ecclesiastes. That is a good summary of how Ecclesiastes deals with money. You've got money? Enjoy it. Spend it. Have fun with it. Because everything in life is hevel. Everything is fleeting. It's like this breath that disappears. But even as you spend it, don't expect that to be all in all. I'm like, go out, have fun, spend the money, but don't expect that to be everything. Ecclesiastes 5:10. Whoever loves money never has enough. It's really true, isn't it? I will be the first to say the love of money is very easy. And I have so often in my life felt, oh, it will be wonderful if I just had more, if I just got more. Thomas will always joke about the fact that I am a side hustler. I love a good side hustle. I've taken up sewing, I've taken up painting, I took up pottery. What else have I taken up? Writing books. I gather side hustles. Like most people gather hobbies, but then I will get a hobby and think, how can I monetize this? And all of a sudden the fun is gone out of it. But I like to think of it as an entrepreneurial spirit. Most of the time though, it's just, oh, I'm not satisfied. I want to fill up the coffers. I want more. And I read this, whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. And the analogy that the author gives, I love it. An eye has never had enough of seeing. I love that analogy. Have you ever been to an art gallery and looked at everything in the art and just been astounded by the talent, the sheer colors, the vibrancy? Have you looked at it all and walked out and thought, yep, I can shut my eyes now. I've seen it all. I've seen enough. No, the eyes are insatiable. We want to see more. And wherever we fix our eyes, our heart is just going to follow. And so if we fix our eyes on wealth, of course, the heart is just going to follow. The author of Ecclesiastes concludes in chapter 5, "This is what I've observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat and to drink and to find satisfaction in their labor under the sun during the few days of life that God has given them. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and be happy in their toil, this is a gift of God." In other words, if you've got some money there, all power to you. Spend it, enjoy it, and don't feel guilty. Oh my goodness, the shame that I carried from my church for enjoying any money that I had, gosh, it was like a weight that I couldn't get rid of. I describe it as a poverty mentality. Even when I got married and we had two incomes and money started to be a bit easier to handle, I still was like, I can't spend money. No, that's unholy. That's not Jesus. I need to be poor. That's wrong. Like, that wasn't Bible speaking. That was shame speaking. And shame is powerful. I love how Jesus summarizes so much of the wisdom literature when it comes to money. Matthew 6, "Don't store up treasures for yourself on earth where moths and vermin destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But if you're going to store up treasures, store them up in heaven where moths and vermin don't destroy, where thieves don't break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." So should you give 10% of your income to New City Church? That's the question that I want to ask as the pastor, as the one who actually gets the money at the end of the day. Should you give 10% of your money to New City Church? Thomas and I don't. We have chosen a number of different initiatives that we think, oh, that is so valuable. We prop up somebody who is working in Jordan. We pay for a large amount of her work there. She's working as a counselor on the front lines of refugee camps to support. And we think, oh, that is such good work that is going on there. We support the Asylum Seeker Resource Center, and we give a bunch of money to New City because we think it's beautiful what's going on here. That's what we've decided to do. For you, if anyone says you need to give 10% of your money to your local church, I would challenge them to find that in the Bible. It's not there. It simply does not exist. The concept of tithing is there, which is 10% of giving. But if you're going to go with the Old Testament and take tithing, then you're going to have to add a whole bunch more offerings on top of that, which ends up being somewhere between 30 and 40% of income, in which case, you know, go for it. And that was to go to the temple, but you know, that was really so that it could be distributed amongst the poor because they didn't have the social welfare system that we have these days. So, you know, take tax out of it. What I'm saying is don't fall in for easy answers, which say 10% of your money has to be given and therefore you're covering XYZ rule. If you're giving out of a place of rules and regulations, you're not giving as God has called to give. And it's not going to create happiness. A far better way, I think, to think about money as we read through the wisdom literature is to think through these postures that we have. So here, let's land it. Last thoughts. Do we have a holistic perspective of wealth as the wisdom literature speaks about it? Something that is fleeting. Here today, gone tomorrow. Something that is a gift of God. something that is to be used for joy, eat, drink, and be merry, a holistic view of wealth. Do we have a posture of generosity and stewardship that sees money coming in and says, I'm not going to hoard this for myself, but I'm going to allow others to thrive. I'm going to allow God's kingdom. I'm going to allow flourishing to work through me. And thirdly, are we coming from a posture of contentment and trust in God? In Ecclesiastes, as the Koheleth speaks, are we trusting God with our material and spiritual needs that are fleeting? There's a lot in there. We could keep going for weeks and weeks just on the concept of money alone. But I wanted to touch on it at least in this series because I do think that it is an incredibly liberating experience to look at how the Bible handles money, to take it out of some of the shame language, take it out of the rules and regulations, and see it as an invitation to partake in God's shalom. I hope that as a church, we are holistically thinking about wealth. I hope that as a community, we are generous with what God has given us. And I hope that as a church, we continue working towards being trusting in God's provision.